Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game and is about to franchise a counselling service for Derby County fans. We are going to clean up. I am Kevin Day and he's Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Hello Kieran, how are you?
I'm as good as can be expected, really. I know I should be too old for this, but winning a match on a Saturday makes you feel fucking brilliant when you wake up on the Sunday morning.
It does indeed. Yeah, I have vague memories of that feeling, yes. Also, I'm slightly relieved that's where you went after you said I should be too old for this, because that could have gone anywhere in the world, really. And have you sorted the dog out? We had a mild off-air dog problem just before we started. Is he okay?
Yeah, he's wandered out of the office into the lounge now, so he's sat in front of the fire.
Ooh, good, get you, Mr. Posh. An office and a fire in the lounge. It's Questions Day, Kieran, but we do have some news stories. And yes, Derby County fans, I'm afraid you are one of them. But the first story is one that Kieran will be interested in, or possibly insisted on having in the script. The price of Himalayan pink salt is through the roof. And also, UEFA says that anyone with a ticket to the Euros has just days to apply for a refund, and if not, could lose their money if their game gets moved.
Yes, UEFA sent out emails last week on Thursday, and they said we can't guarantee the tournament takes place, and if it doesn't take place, or if matches take place behind closed doors, then we will give you a refund, you know, June, July, whenever it's going to be. However, if you feel you don't want to go to a match, you've got 10 days to get your refund application in. And I was humming and hawing about, because I've got 10 tickets, and I was really looking forward to, you know, see England play at Wembley in a tournament. Yeah, it's always a good fun with that. But then when you go through the terms and conditions, and as you know, I like a bit of small print, Kevin. There's various references to force majeure, and it says here that if the match cannot take place in that particular country, so let's say that England's match gets moved to Spain or Russia or Germany, under those circumstances, you will not get a refund, and getting to that match and playing for the flight and the accommodation and the time off work, that's your problem. So I think it's put a lot of fans, especially England fans, in a bit of a dilemma, because if the match doesn't take place, you know, I might have work commitments around that time of year. Certainly getting to Wembley's not a problem, but getting to Madrid, getting to Azerbaijan, getting to wherever it's going to be. It does seem a bit harsh by UEFA. I mean, they have sold 3 million tickets for the tournament, and it's worth an absolute fortune in terms of the money for them, because I think we've discussed the ticket prices before. To me, it seems harsh. I mean, if they have to move the tournament, then surely under those circumstances, you should get a refund. But I mean, they have been clear, but it's not a lot of time to get your ass into gear to put in for that refund. And I'm also slightly concerned that when you actually read the terms and conditions, is that the money will be refunded to your credit card that you used to buy the tickets. But of course, the tickets were sold in 2019. Now, 18 months later, many people, that their credit cards will have expired. And therefore, it's going to be an absolute ball ache to go through more and more paperwork in terms of proving that a individual bank account is linked to that credit card and things of this nature. So it's going to be an administrative nightmare. And even if you do put in for a refund, UEFA are saying it's going to take probably at least another 30 days on top of that. So they've had people's money for 18 months, best part of 2 years in many respects, sitting in their bank account, earning them interest whilst we've been sitting around it. And to a certain extent, I feel slightly shafted.
Well, most days of the week, Kieran, you feel slightly shafted, to be perfectly honest. But there's an interesting one here, Kieran. I mean, Moscow for you would be a mixed blessing, because obviously you'd have accommodation there, but you wouldn't be able to get past that massive photograph of you at the airport, I'm guessing. Surely, I don't look at, obviously, as you know me, Kieran, of course I don't look at the small print on any ticket. But I guess on like most match day tickets or even entertainment tickets, it says, you know, this could be cancelled or moved or transferred, and we have no responsibility if that happens, doesn't it? It's not, this is not unique, is it?
It isn't unique, and certainly if you buy a ticket for a football match and it gets moved by TV, for example, from 3 o'clock on a Saturday to 7:45 on a Monday, I think you buy it in good faith with the potential knowledge that you might not get to see the match at the time you originally envisaged. But even so, you know, if Palace said, "Oh, by the way, next home match against whoever it is, we're shifting it to Valencia, or we're shifting it to Azerbaijan, we're not going to give you your money back. You've got to go and schlep over there." You would feel fairly peeved. So changing dates and times due to events beyond control, and you know, you work in the entertainment industry, you are an artist, and you know, I've been to gigs which have been delayed because the singer's, you know, tonsils are playing up, or or you know, the bass player's got so blind drunk that he can't find his way to the gig, and you say, well, okay, it'll be rescheduled. You take those on the chin, but you still expect it to take place at the same venue and the same town. You know, to actually move fixtures in terms of countries and give no compensation does seem harsh.
Yeah, I'm also interested in that 30 days as well, because I'm still waiting for my first season ticket refund from Palace, and their definition of 5 working days seems to be 5 days in this year that I've worked, which means it's going to be around December till I finally get... I keep saying, Saturday and Sunday doesn't count. Well, a lot of people work on Saturdays and Sundays. Why is that not a work... Also, I can never quite understand why it never works. When UEFA want your money, it goes straight into their account the next day.
Oh, kaboom.
It takes 30 days. Just, you mentioned force majeure, Kieran, and this is not on our list of news or questions, but it came up on Friday that the High Court ruled in favour of quite a few hospitality companies against insurance companies who are claiming force majeure as a reason to not pay money during the COVID pandemic. Are football clubs involved in that High Court case as well, do we know?
Yes, they are, because they would qualify as small and medium-sized businesses, and many of them have business interruption insurance. So this could actually, it's a really good point you've raised there, Kevin. This could impact upon those clubs that have put in for claims. I thought it was fairly reprehensible of the insurance industry to try to wriggle out of it, given the impact that the pandemic's had on small business. But in terms of football, yes, it could be excellent news for those clubs that have paid the premiums. I mean, they are quite pricey premiums, but they certainly will. I mean, I was talking to one chief executive, and this was before the ruling, and he said they were hoping that this would go, they would get some benefit from this. So fingers crossed, the insurance companies won't try to transfer this to yet another court in terms of their standard approach of delaying doing everything, and B, they'll get their fingers out and they will settle these claims before those businesses go bust, because it's all very well getting an insurance compensation, but the aim is to allow the business owners a wee bit more breathing space until hopefully we will return to some form of lockdown ceasing to be the case once the vaccination program goes through a tipping point where people can start to feel a little bit safer from an individual and a national health perspective.
We're only 9 minutes into this, Kieran. So far you've called me an artist and said I made a fair point. I'm having a good pod. I've started early. I think Jamie Redknapp would be picking me out, saying he's having a good game there, isn't he? Kieran, as you know, my one concession to professionalism is getting the email from Guy and writing notes. So I write the script out and write notes. And normally I do some little notes to myself and little things to say to you. But for our next news story, Kieran, I've just written down Derby County, basically.
Yes.
And the word in brackets, discuss.
We could have. And in fact, I've been contacted by the Derby County blog to say, are we renaming
official
the
Derby
show?
Right.
the price of Derby County, because yet again, they have a lot taking place at the club.
Yeah.
And as we've always said, if you get mentioned on this show once or twice, that you know, it's flip a coin. Quite often, it's good news stories.
Yeah.
If you're appearing on a regular basis, it tends to mean that it's not good news. And sadly, none of the issues that I've got written down here right. Are particularly positive. So if we start off with wages, apparently Derby had paid half of the wages in December, but half is outstanding. And their wage bill, we don't know for exact sure because they've not published accounts for so long, but their wage bill was in between £3 to £4 million a month. So they've not had the resources to pay the December wages. Clearly, Wayne Rooney has been appointed as full-time manager, and congratulations to him for that. Mm. But trying to motivate the players who haven't been paid, it adds complications to a job which is already challenging. And of course, yesterday they played at home to Rotherham, which, yeah. You know, relegation dogfight, to quote a cliche, and they lost at home. I'm not saying that the non-payment of wages is the reason for it, but it's not going to help. Mm. And the club has been criticised by people connected to players who are saying the club's communication has been sort of fairly offhand. You know, an email towards the end of December to say, well, we're not going to pay you the full amount this month, and then sort of radio silence for a few days. You know, if there's bad news, you've got to keep people on board. Mm. And I don't think the club's exactly helped itself here. So that's the first bit of news, which isn't great. Second bit of news, we're moving on to the takeover by Sheikh Khaled and the Derventio Consortium. Now, by all accounts, terms were agreed, but we were told that terms had been agreed some time ago. The deal was initially going to take place in December, then before Christmas, then before the new year. We're now up to, we're recording this on the 17th of January, and still nothing's happened. You know, I've been told that, you know, funds have been put in place, and then somebody says, well, it might take time for the money to be transferred across. Now, we're living in 2021. Money transfers instantly, I can assure you. And anybody that works in any arm of finance and banking, yes, there could be just some, you know, quick checks and balances to make sure that the money's not come from inappropriate sources. Mm. But we are talking, you know, a day or two at most. So That's a cause for concern. So you therefore have to ask yourself, why has the deal not gone through? Mm. And looking at the potential parties, well, first of all, we've got the EFL. There's an owners and directors test, but given that the deal had been agreed, you'd assume that the owners and directors test has been passed, although perhaps there could be things outstanding there. Secondly, the EFL have got an appeal in terms of one of the rulings that when they charged Derby County, and this is the amortisation case, which I know as a big amortisation fan, you're desperate to find the final final ruling on that, but that's dragging on. That could impact upon the price.
Yeah,
because if Derby are found guilty of the charges, the tariff in terms of fines or points deductions could be applied, and therefore that would have an impact upon where they could be potentially be playing next season. There could be an issue in terms of the price. Is the price linked to where Derby County are at the end of the season? And this is the thing which I think fans fear most of all, is the owner a tire kicker who's just a glorified tire kicker? There have been issues with this potential owner before. Was linked at one stage with Newcastle. There's talk about unpaid bills to a party. We don't know how accurate those claims are, and so on. So that's where we are in terms of the takeover. And then another story came out that the club might therefore be applying to further loans to this company who we're starting to see more and more of in the world of football finance, this company called MSD Holdings. Mm. It's involved with Burnley in terms of a loan of somewhere between £60 to £80 million to the new owner. It has lent money to Derby County before. If there is a takeover, most sort of loans organised by sort of specialist boutiques will have what's referred to as a change of control clause, which could mean that A, they're entitled to their money back when a new owner comes in, or B, if they do a risk assessment to the new owner, it could be that there's an interest rate hike, or that the present owners of Derby County will have to pay some form of financial penalty. So they're involved. They've been spoken about in terms of further funding, and then there was another report. This was in one of the papers at the week. As a result of this, there is a potential for Derby County to go into administration. And we have a bit of a giggle about Derby, but you know, in an affectionate way, there is no way you want any club to be going into administration, because that means two things: A, job losses, and B, some schmucks can be charging £300 or £400 an hour for the privilege of being the administrator. But it also would result in an automatic 12-point penalty, which, given where Derby are in the league, you know, it's bad news. So, you know, I'm really sorry, Derby fans. We want to have a good news Derby story on the show, and every week it's not.
Yeah, the worrying thing is, Kieran, that when we first started discussing Derby, as you say, almost with a smile on our face, it was about, you know, stadium valuation shenanigans, and now it's developing by increments in what is fast becoming a more serious story. The Wayne Rooney thing is interesting. Under normal circumstances, I would say that Wayne Rooney becoming the manager was a very good move. He's a very intelligent young man, despite what the tabloids would have you think. He's a very deep thinker about football, and of course, he's one of the best footballers of his generation. But the circumstances in which he's become manager, there are people suggesting that he's no longer player manager, he's manager. So does that mean his wages are now off, his player wages are off the bill? But also, presumably, he's not become manager for the sake of it, for gratis, has he?
No. I mean, he would have had a contract. Remember, he was sort of a player coach when he first joined the club. I've seen Wayne Rooney play for England and against Brighton. I just can't understand why he's never been given the love that he should have had.
I couldn't agree more. I absolutely, like Ashley Cole, absolutely. I quite agree.
It's always sort of been a bit of a sneering attitude towards him, because he comes from a working class Liverpool background. I know Everton fans were unhappy with him moving to Manchester United, but it was the opportunity to play for a club that was playing in the Champions League every year. You want a local lad to play for your club. I fully understand that. But his achievements for England were amazing, and he just sort of slipped away out of English football without the same type of reverence as other players. And you're absolutely right. He's hugely underrated. Anybody you talk to in the football industry, and you know, I've got family that work in football, they speak very highly of him. And he's a good thinker, and he's very progressive captain and leader. And I just wish him all the best at Derby County itself. But I presume that he will have signed a different contract as manager to that of player coach. So yes, there will be a monetary change. How big that will be is unknown. Clearly, the previous manager, when he was sacked, will be subject to, he'll be entitled to compensation. But it's going to rattle on. It's not good for the fans. It's not good for the club, and it's not good for Mel Morris, the owner, who has put, you know, he's a lifelong fan. He's put huge sums of money into the club. And I think it's tainting his legacy at the club as well. Yeah, he's got good intentions. I don't agree with some of the financial disclosure issues and policies used. I think that they were, for me, it was creative accounting 101. But, even so, as we say, every club is part of the community, and Derby fans deserve a bit of peace and quiet.
Yeah, we need to rattle on, Kieran. So what I'm going to do, if you don't mind, there are a couple of smaller news stories. I'm going to hold them over for the news pod on Thursday, because we've got a lot of decent questions that need to be answered in some detail. So we've got, stories about basically numbers, that how much the Premier League clubs own. There's a story about Man City and a young Brazilian player, and there's a story about the West Brom takeover. But I think they'll all still be stories on Thursday, Kieran, won't they?
Yeah. So let's
get into the questions, if you don't mind. The first question comes from Joshua Selig, who's a regular listener. Hello, Joshua. Joshua says, rumours again of a proposed European Super League, which reminds Joshua of previous ideas for various linked-up leagues, such as the Nordic League, the Atlantic League, the Dutch-Belgian League, etc. Joshua's question is, if the European Super League does happen, which I think is looking increasingly likely eventually, what could be the next move for the lower-ranked European teams, those teams that have talked about Atlantic Leagues and Nordic Leagues, etc.?
Well, I think Joshua is right to raise this. The European Super League is one of those threats which tend to arise every time there is a renegotiation of the format of the Champions League and the way that the money is being distributed. So this is sort of, this is classic saber rattling by those clubs who want to make more money out of European football. If we'll either end up with a Super League or a Champions League, which is more of a closed shop in the sense that clubs from the five main countries in Europe, in terms of revenue generation, which is clearly England, Spain, Italy, France, and Germany, they want to really get a stranglehold on the revenues. This leaves the middle tier countries, effectively, the equivalent of the likes of Palace and Brighton and West Brom and Burnley, who are in the, from a Premier League perspective, where are those clubs going to be left if these individual big clubs go off and play down their own end of the street? There is a lot of logic in having some joined up national leagues. From a geographical perspective, Belgium and the Netherlands, you can see the rationale behind that. Would it make sense to add in Portugal and Scotland into an Atlantic League? There is a case for that. There is a case against that as well. But some form of consolidation could arise if those clubs in those countries want to have a product which is attractive to TV viewers, because it is TV contracts which drive everything, and whatever this new form of Champions League, Super League is going to be, that is geared simply to getting more viewers and more money, and that money being concentrated in the hands of fewer clubs. So I do expect some form of change. How radical or how gentle it's going to be, we won't find out until 2024.
Happy New Year from the sponsor of this episode of The Price of Football, our below-the-waist grooming partner, Manscaped. Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels and is here to help you have clean balls in the new year. Kieran, I think both of our balls are clean all year round, but it's essential that they're clean for the new year, Kieran, isn't it?
It certainly is, Kevin. It is New Year. I've just been taking down the Christmas decorations and I've noticed that all my baubles are smooth from the Christmas tree, so I've decided to replicate that with my own. And I couldn't do that unless I'd manscaped here to give myself a New Year's resolution that I fully intend to keep, and I'd recommend our listeners consider this as well. If you go for the Perfect Package 3.0, it's for below-the-waist activity, and it will help you start off the year pretty strong. And you'll get the Lawn Mower 3.0, which is your trimming device that will help you to come out of quarantine with cleaner balls. And if you're worried, and if you've not done this type of thing before, I fully understand. It's waterproof, so you can do it in the shower, and it's skin safe. So if you're worried about nicking your two best friends, rest in peace on that. It's got a third generation trimmer. So if you're going for careful grooming down there, it even shines a light. And shining light on your testicles in 2021 could be one of the most exciting things we do during quarantine. So I thoroughly recommend that. And if you want to freshen things up down there, they've got the Crop Preserver. It's an anti-chafing ball deodorant and moisturizer. And if you want the for freshness down there, we've got Ball Toner Spray, which these guys have referred to as the Crop Reviver. So start the new year with a fresh set of testes, thanks to Manscaped.
Well said, Kieran. If you or a friend want the besties for your testes, go to manscaped.com and get 20% off plus free shipping using the code PRICEOFOOTBALL. That's 20% off and free shipping at manscaped.com. Now, Toby Bowles has one of those questions that are seemingly very simple, but could leave us here for hours discussing it. Because Toby says, what's the best way to get a job involved in the decision-making of a football club? How do sporting directors, chairmen and CEOs get their positions? Do you need a degree or a background in a certain field? Now, cynically, Kieran, you would say it helps to be white, male and rich, but are there things that these people have in common? Is there a career path if you want, like Toby, to be involved in the decision making of a football club?
Well, I mean, that former career can be diverse. I mean, you could, of course, have been the director of Horny Housewives on the Job, as we saw happen at West Ham recently. But in terms of getting into the football industry, It is a tough gig because there's an awful lot of people that want to work in the industry, and supply far exceeds demand. I mean, I get regular emails from students at various universities and other people thinking about a career break saying, yeah, how did I get into the football industry? And my standard reply is, well, I'm not in the football industry. Mm. I'm just a teacher who talks about it. There are specialist courses now. I'm not trying to blow our own trumpet here, but we at Liverpool, we teach the football industry's MBA, and we have high profile speakers come to the course. You know, the likes of Rick Parry and Neil Doncaster, and chief executives of Premier League clubs and other clubs, and people from scouting organisations and the Deloitte Football Group, and so on. So getting to know people, I think, is really important, building up a network and having something to offer as well. Because if you can prove yourself to be an expert or have knowledge in a particular field of football, then somebody's going to start asking you one or two questions. Your name will become more widely known, and that can be the vehicle into getting into the game. But in terms of Toby's question, in terms of specialist qualifications, you don't need them. You know, sometimes if you can prove that you've got transferable skills, there is no difference to running a football club on a day-to-day basis if you're a finance director to that of a washing machine manufacturer. You've still got to look at budgets, you've still got to look at your tax issues, you've still got to look at planning and looking at, you know, why are things not working as well as we expected. And anybody that's good at being able to do the forensics, to being able to do the analysis, and also being able to present to the rest of the board, it's those skills that will get you further in the industry. It is, however, quite an insular industry. We have spoken about the sort of the old boys network, which has some merits and some demerits. I think it is disillusioning for women in football, because there's not adequate representation there. There's not adequate representation if you're from an ethnic minority background and things of this nature. But you can only change these things one step at a time. And we are seeing more and more people coming up with more and more ideas. You know, we've had people on the show who have been ex-footballers who've tried to set up alternative methods of scouting, legal representation, and so on. And you can then use that as a sign that you are worthy of taking on. And football clubs do offer internships. So, sometimes it's something as you could just be in the right place at the right time. And you write to a club, is there an internship in this, that, or the other? I'm be prepared to work for peanuts or nothing at all. Yeah, I'll be honest there. Mm. You show them your body of work to date. Show them you're a professional person. And just take things on from there. Or, I to a certain extent, I started this by doing a blog.
Mm.
And then that sort of expanded into a Twitter account, and then I got to know you and things of this nature. So sometimes it's just a case of putting yourself out there, trying to do things slightly differently or try to do things in a professional manner. You will get noticed if what you do is of a decent standard.
Yeah, and we've spoken to quite a few press communications people at clubs at various levels, who most of whom have got into football from, I suppose, what you consider more humble backgrounds, that's similar backgrounds to us. But the other answer to Toby's question, unfortunately, is if you're talking about being involved in decision making at the very highest levels of football, then the easiest way is either to be an oil-rich potentate or to win the lottery and buy a football club, because otherwise decision-making at those very high levels is something that's cut off from the rest of us, essentially, isn't it, Kieran, really? No matter how hard you work as a club employee, you're not going to get to the very level where you're making decisions that affect the actual future of the club, essentially.
Does it help to be a billionaire? Yes, certainly does. Yeah. But remember that the owners quite often will delegate the day-to-day responsibilities in terms of running the club to professionals. And in terms of, will the owner have to say ultimately the thumbs up or thumbs down in terms of funding a new transfer, change of manager, and so on? Yes, they will. But a lot more of the day-to-day decisions will be delegated to professionals. Steve Parrish, you think about his role at Palace. He came into it as to rescue the club, and now he is making those decisions. Yeah, he is independently wealthy, but he's at the same time he works with a team around him, a communications director. Quite often you'll see communications directors used to be fanzine editors.
That's true.
Who reported on the club, and then the club will say to them, well, somebody who writes the club program. That person's moving on. Do you fancy a go at that? And there is a career path, but it's not easy.
Yeah, I'm glad that Steve Parrish got a bit of love there, because I know he listens to the pod occasionally. He'll be pleased about that. Hello, Steve. Five working days, Steve. Come on, sort that out. Toby, good luck. If you were asking that question with regards to trying to get a career in football, good luck to you. One of Kieran and I's little sidelines is fake references, basically. So if you need a reference, just drop us a line. We'll be happy to say whatever you want to whatever club. John Rooney, our second Rooney of the day. John Rooney says, do you know how much has been paid in total so far to broadcasting companies in the form of COVID rebates?
Right. In terms of amounts which have been paid, actually, I suspect that there's been nothing or close to nothing.
Oh, okay.
And the reason for that is that if we take a look at the Premier League, my understanding is that the broadcasters are entitled to a £360 million rebate. But what they've said, because it's in Sky and BT's and Amazon Prime's in their interests that football continues, they've said, we will, instead of asking for a cash rebate, we will reduce what we're going to be paying you from the instalments over the course of the next 3 years. Mm. So that, from a cash flow perspective, that's really good for the clubs. The clubs are being hit heavily at present due to matches taking place behind closed doors. So I think the sum has been agreed of £360 million in the Premier League. Then there is the issue to do with China. That's cost the Premier League probably around about £150 million in terms of cash that didn't arrive. So they had signed a contract and the Chinese broadcast partner didn't pay. So that's cost money. As far as the EFL are concerned, The EFL TV deal is worth £119 million a year, and there's been a relatively small deduction from that. I think that was in line with some of the matches weren't played. I think the playoffs were some of the playoffs one legs, and the Carabao Cup semi final one legs. So I think there's only probably only a £7 or 8 million adjustment, and again that adjustment will come through in payments by Sky to the EFL over a period of time. The organisation which has had the biggest hit financially, it looks like it's going to be UEFA, because if you recall. The matches which did take place in terms of the knockouts towards the end of last season, many of those became one-legged, and of course, you know, that's where the excitement is from a TV broadcast perspective. They get good ratings, so if all of a sudden a two-leg match becomes one-legged, it means that there are genuine holes which are not going to be filled at a later date. Ultimately, all of last season's Premier League games took place. So therefore, you know, the broadcaster said, well, we weren't happy when the matches took place, but you know, we're not going to go piling in. For the EFL, yes, the broadcasters missed out in terms of the of League One and League Two matches not taking place, but the Championship continued and so on. So, but for UEFA, I think they're looking at a hit of around about £500 million, and again, my understanding that's going to be spread over a period of years.
Do you think, Kieran? We're getting used now to, in the Premier League especially, 6 o'clock midweek kickoffs, 8 o'clock Sunday night kickoffs, 3 o'clock games being televised. When this is over, and it will be, do you think the idea of 3 o'clock kickoffs on a Saturday and those games not being televised will be completely anachronistic? Do you think with that genie's not going back in the bottle?
Well, presently it's down to legislation. You know, there is a protection of the sort of, you know, the sacrosanct 3 p.m. kickoff on a Saturday in order to protect clubs in the EFL. Because if there is a, for want of a better phrase, a big match taking place at 3 o'clock on a Saturday, you know, for you or I, we wouldn't give a damn. You know, we would go to support our clubs. Mm. But there are some fans who are, you know, more of a walk-up basis. If the weather's dreadful and we're talking about, you know, Colchester versus Grimsby or something of that nature, you might take a look outside and say, well, you know, West Ham are playing Spurs live on the telly. It's already part of my package. I'm not paying any extra for it. All of a sudden, it can have an impact. And if you take a look at the attendance figures for clubs in League One and League Two and the Championship, when their matches are clashing with Champions League matches, there does appear to be an impact upon attendances, which is why 3 p.m. has always been sort of ring-fenced by the government. But what the government's approach is going to be post-COVID, nobody really knows. But I am concerned that we will find what we have at present to be the new normal, and for football matches to go one after the other in terms of broadcast. Mm. But you know, Sky and BT and Amazon haven't paid for those matches. Mm. Yeah, they have bought half of the Premier League matches. Now, if the Premier League is going to use this as the basis to sell all of the matches and say, you know, there's going to be four matches back to back on a Saturday, four matches back to back on a Sunday, one on a Friday, one on a Monday, then, you know, the reaction of the broadcasters, I think, will be intriguing, and that will dictate, you know, if they're not prepared to offer a lot more money, then I think we might return to seeing a few more matches at 3 o'clock on a Saturday. I know we're both old school, you and I. There is nothing better than a 3 o'clock Saturday kickoff, because it means getting to the pub with your mates at 11:30. Mm. It means going back there you're in there for 5:15. And then you get home, you know, at an appropriate, inappropriate hour. And anything which isn't that isn't quite the same. So, I might be a dinosaur here, but I'm hoping that we'll go back to having, you know, three or four matches kicking off at 3 o'clock on a Saturday. And, you know, with no disrespect to the clubs that we support, our clubs are more likely to play at that time because, if we're playing Burnley or Sheffield United, it doesn't tend to be one of the matches which is chosen for live football.
Yeah, fair enough. I'm sorry, I'm just sitting here thinking about 3 o'clock kickoffs in the pub. Matty Bergin has asked an interesting question, I think. All our questions are interesting, but Matty's one that is particularly so. Leicester City signed George Hurst, the son of Sheffield Wednesday legend David Hurst, from their Belgian sister team, OH Leuven. Apparently, so they wouldn't have to pay a transfer fee to Sheffield Wednesday. Matty says, is this legal? And should Wednesday be entitled to money as his move to Belgium, then Leicester happened after his contract expired? I think you may have answered your own question there, Matty. But what I find interesting in this, Kieran, is what is the relationship with a sister club? I mean, are you just investing in another European club and making that a sister club? How does that work? Are there contracts involved? So if you could answer Matty's question first and then maybe just tell us a little bit about that relationship, I'd be interested.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Okay, looking at this lad, George Hurst, he made his debut for Sheffield Wednesday. He was very young. He made it in 2016-17. And then for whatever reason, the relationship soured. I think there was some form of contract dispute. At the time, Leicester was supposed to be very interested in him. He was a very promising young player. There'd been talk about Leicester making a £2 million bid. And things didn't work out between Sheffield Wednesday and George Hurst, and his contract therefore expired. So, you know, under the Bosman ruling, he's entitled to move, and he joined Leuven in Belgium under a Bosman. Now, because he was under 23, Sheffield Wednesday were entitled to a fixed compensation payment, but it's not very much.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then he did okay at Leuven, and then he was sold to Leicester. Now, I think Sheffield Wednesday fans, they're saying, well, was this a ploy? Because if he had gone from Sheffield Wednesday to Leicester at the end of his contract, there could have been a greater compensation fee. So I think that's the concern. Is it legal? My understanding, having spoken to one of my legal friends, is yes, it is. He says it's one of those things which might leave a sour taste in the mouth, but contracts are contracts, and they are signed between individuals and employers, and therefore you have to view it from that perspective. In terms of sort of the second question, so he's gone to Leicester, yet he has played in the Premier League. I think actually he's on loan presently at Rotherham, part of his development. And remember, we spoke to Leicester's development manager.
Yes, indeed.
So it's all linked in some way. In terms of relationships, they can be formal or informal. There's formal relationships in terms of the City Football Group. City Football Group own Manchester City and clubs in New York and Melbourne and Japan and China and Belgium and France. And they're just in the habit of doing one somewhere else. I think it's Paraguay. There can be formal links where one club will have one organization will have a sort of a statutory investment in the form of shares, or it could be more of an informal relationship whereby we agree to work together as friends, as partners. Those are sort of the two types of arrangement. I know Chelsea have had one historically with a club in Belgium, and I think Manchester United have as well. So, they tend to be there's benefits to both clubs. If you can lend three or four players to another club, it makes the loan manager's job that much easier. The players themselves, there's faces they already know from their host club. So that's why these sort of informal relationships sometimes are created.
Yeah, if we had more time, and I've just noticed how long we've been chatting for, and we still have a few questions, I would probably ask you how Brexit is going to affect that. But I'm going to let one of our listeners, inevitably somebody will ask a question off the back of that to say, how will Brexit affect these sister club relationships with European clubs? But in the meantime, David Beniston is a Sheffield United fan, and he wants to know how many clubs in the Premier League and Championship have taken the same stance as Sheffield United and are not requiring fans to buy season tickets at all for this season, and how many have required fans to pay for season tickets in full.
Right, well, I guess to a certain extent I'm going to have to go on David's naughty set, because I started to work my way through on a club-by-club basis and then realised that if I did that, I wouldn't have enough time to research all the other questions. But there are a variety of approaches being taken. I know that Watford have taken the same approach as Sheffield United, and they didn't ask season ticket holders for any money. We've got clubs such as, you know, yours and mine and Newcastle who did take money and then have subsequently offered refunds, and some of those have been paid, and some of those are on the longest 5 days of all time tab, from what you're saying, Kevin. And then there's some which are sort of taken an interim viewpoint, which says we will take a quarter payment this year. So there have been a variety, but everybody should be aware that a season ticket gives you contractual rights, and if the club has failed to deliver, you are entitled to a refund, so don't be fobbed off. The trouble is, you know, if you threaten to go down the legal route, small claims courts it'll be a pain in the backside. I'm sorry about that noise in the background. That's the dog with his squeaky chipmunk.
Is it?
Yes.
Is it really? Is it a coincidence that squeaks as you said it's a pain in the backside? He's got a Well, of course, that's so Sussex. He's got a squeaky chipmunk. He couldn't just have a squeaky dog bone like everybody else has got. He's got a squeaky chipmunk. All right, well, let's... David, I apologise that he's now on your naughty step. Kieran's on a lot of people's naughty steps, I have to say. There's a lot of naughty steps in this country that you are booking space on, aren't it? Have you taken the chipmunk off him, or is we going to get...
Well, yeah, he's come to me. He's trying to scrounge a biscuit off me.
Is the attention seeker? It would be a nice biscuit as well, I imagine, where you are. Tony McNeary, hello, Tony, points out that you said, Kieran, on a recent pod, that after laying off a number of footballing scouts, Arsenal were looking at a player-finding process that was more driven by data than, shall we say, the old boy network of scouting. How much of the Moneyball process of finding and hiring undervalued assets, as supposedly practiced by the Fenway Sports Group, is myth versus reality in the Premier League today? So we hear a lot about Moneyball, Kieran, but is it actually taking place?
Yes, it is. Clubs are investing large sums of money, either through having relationships with the likes of Smarter Scout, Scout Stats Bomb, Y Scout. Some of them even have relationships with Football Manager, because, you know, whilst people see Football Manager as a game which occupies many of their hours, all that you see in terms of the interface on Football Manager is about 20 different statistical representations of a player. But behind that, there's a second wave of stats, and I understand Football Manager actually sell those to individual clubs. And of course, we had Darren Robinson on the show last year, you know, and he was operating again some sort of talent identification using statistical as sort of combining that with sort of the more of the visual observations that scouting has had historically. So it is reality. In my view, the three best clubs in the Premier League in terms of the adaption, or the adoption of Moneyball tactics, are Liverpool, Manchester City, and Leicester. And if you take a look at their trophy cabinet recently and where they are in the Premier League, I think those dividends and that investment, which started a few years ago, so it's not going to work instantly. And I think this is why some clubs, especially those clubs perhaps towards the bottom of divisions, when they're having to make urgent decisions, you need to have the people that understand the data. And unfortunately, you need to employ nerds. You know, and speaking as an unemployed nerd at some point in my life, yeah, I'm quite grateful for that. It's all very well having the data. It's understanding the data that's really important. And those clubs have gone down that particular route of employing people with PhDs in very complex statistical analysis as part of their scouting network. At the same time, the manager is involved, or the director of football would be involved in these decisions. And sometimes, statistics, and certainly as somebody that plays with numbers all the time, I can make numbers look good or bad by being selective. So I think you have to be a little bit cautious with relation to this, and to see that you're not just employing an addendum of individual statistics. You're employing a young man or a young woman if you're playing in the WSL, and you're looking for different parts of their personality. Are they going to fit in with the culture of the club and things of that nature? So you should never make a decision purely based on a statistical analysis, but it is a good way of sieving out a lot of things which in theory should make the final decision a wee bit easier.
Hmm. Chris Barrett is a long-standing season ticket holder at Reading. I have no problem with that. Chris, what I do have a problem with is your ground having a jazz cafe. That's really another step down a slippery slope.
Well, at West Ham, under the new ownership, it could have a jizz cafe.
That's very funny. Chris is... I'm going to write that down. I'm just going to change the A in jazz to... Chris is very keen to get back to watch football, as we all are, as discussed earlier. But he's interested to understand what you think about fans adhering to social distancing guidelines when, in my experience, says Chris, you can't even get fans to sit down, and guilty as charged, says Chris. Now, on the face of it, Kieran, that's not a football finance question, except it is, because I can't imagine that we will go from no fans in May to all the fans in August, and there will be guidelines. And usually the sanction for repeatedly breaking any stadium rules is a rescinding of a season ticket, isn't it?
There's the rescinding of the season ticket, but remember also the safety advisory group at every ground. Mm. They have the rights to close either the whole ground or sections of it. And it could be that as we return, and it's, as you say, it's not going to be an all or nothing. We're not going to go from zero to 30,000 in terms of people attending matches. It is going to be tiered. If there are observed offences, and football again seems to be used as a political diversion at present. We've seen the big fuss made about players celebrating goals.
Yes.
My view is that when we came back out of lockdown last June, everybody was able to score a goal and they did keep their distance.
Yeah.
I think practically everything, lockdown 2 and 3, we're not adhering to the rules with the same degree of devotion as we did historically. And that's also applied to player goal celebrations. Now, if players are going to start jumping on each other and hugging, then if that's what fans see, then we're going to do the same.
Yeah.
In terms of social distancing, I don't know what it's like at other grounds. I know the one match I did go to when I saw Brighton play Sheffield United, you were seated four seats apart from everybody. I sit in the standing area, if you know what I mean. I've always had a season ticket behind a goal, and the clubs, like many clubs, they turn a blind eye to fans in that area actually standing and making some noise. There was a far more authoritarian approach taken, and when we were forced to sit down, which was frustrating. But if that's what it takes to have to go and see a football match, then yes. So yeah, I agree with you entirely. I think the clubs will be monitoring fans who are in breach of the rules, and also the politicians who have been making a bit of hay in relation to this in terms of goal celebrations, which Yeah, they are avoidable to a certain extent, or to a total extent. But it is a contact sport, so you can spread the disease just as easy from marking somebody at a corner. I think it's not going to be easy, but it's a price worth paying.
Yeah, these things are avoidable, Kieran, just as the Prime Minister not travelling 7 miles on his bike away from home is avoidable as well. So, yeah, I think
it's distraction tactics.
If the rules are going to apply, and as you say, football's often used as a something to kick, which is obviously part of the game, but, you know, if we're all going to abide by the rules, that's fine. But if only some of us are, then you do wonder why it's footballers that get the stick as ever. And I think an unfortunate side effect of Marcus Rashford's brilliant work is that there are politicians who will be looking to do anything they can to paint football in a bad light. David Gill is a Leeds fan. Jeez, good job yesterday, David. Well, that's an unexpectedly annoying result. Neil Mopay scored as well. I don't know if you probably would have been watching the game, but Tim Sherwood over on the results service on Sky was busily explaining how Brighton can't score goals and were probably going down just as the news came in that they were 1-0 up at Leeds. So there you go. But David's got a question. Now, I don't think we've been asked this before, which is interesting because it's not an obvious one, David. I don't mean to insult you, but it's one that you think would have been asked before because it's a big question. David says at Leeds, and I quote, were royally shafted last year by international managers taking their players for Nations League games and pointless friendlies. And as an example, uses Liam Cooper, who was injured for some time after playing for Scotland. And David just wants to know, are international teams obliged to compensate clubs in any way for injuries sustained in international duties?
Right. This is intriguing. I presume David Gill, as a Leeds fan, he's not the same David Gill who is the former Manchester United chief executive.
You'd guess not, wouldn't you?
Would be a surprise.
He'd probably know.
Yes, you would hope he would, yes. The ruling is, and this is quite disturbing in certain respects, there is an agreement between FIFA, UEFA, and the European Club Association that compensation will be paid for a player who is injured on international duty, but only in the final stages of a tournament.
Really?
So,
oh, crikey. Okay.
In the World Cup, it will be, you know, in the World Cup tournament itself. The qualifiers don't count. Exactly the same for the Euro 2020 tournament. But the African Cup of Nations, it's not mentioned here. So I don't know whether players who are injured in that tournament are covered. And it can be really costly for a club. And I think a classic example would be that of Dean Ashton.
Yeah,
who I always thought was going to be a cracking player for England, and he was tragically injured training at an England camp before an international, and that ended up finishing off his career. But he was at West Ham at the time, and they had to go and pay up the rest. They had to pay his wages for the remainder of his contract, which does intuitively seem very, very harsh. But if that had been a World Cup tournament, FIFA would have paid up under their scheme. And certainly, when I've looked at FIFA's accounts in looking at the last two tournaments, the amount of money that's been paid out has been quite sizable.
Now, Kieran, our penultimate question comes from Matt Keep or Kipe or Keep. It's only got four letters, K-E-I-P, and I've already had three ways to get it wrong, possibly. So I apologise, Matt, if you could let me know how. I'd be interested to know how that is pronounced. But Matt is in Canada and discovered our pod in the early stages of the pandemic, and he loves it. He loves it, Kieran. He loves our pod. Thank you, Matt. And here in Canada, Matt says that he can watch for free the Russian Premier League, the USL Championship, the A-League, the J-League, the K-League, the Liga Primera de Nicaragua, select games from the DFB Pokal, which is a German cup competition, and a game of the week in German Tier 3. How do these leagues justify making their games for free, says Matt. Not that he's complaining, although I imagine the Baroness would be Kieran. Sorry, darling. Guys asked me to watch the Nicky Wagyuan game for the pod tomorrow. It's a good point. I mean, that's a lot of football to watch for nothing, isn't it?
It is a lot of football. I presume the A-League is the Australian League.
It is.
It's not the Viz Profanosaurus definition, which I'll refer to after the show.
Sorry. I know what it is, which is why I'm giggling. Sorry. I'm still giggling at Giz Cafe, to be perfectly honest, which is very, very childish. And if only Guy shared our childish sense of humour instead of being so serious in his quest for gold.
And professional,
exactly. Go on.
The reason why the football is available for free is because it can't be sold for a fee.
Ah, I see.
Because there it simply isn't demand.
Right.
In Canada,
right.
What is the demand to watch Russian football?
Fair point.
So therefore, by putting it out on a social media channel such as YouTube, a little bit of money is being generated because, as you're probably aware, I'm a big consumer of YouTube. There's adverts before everything, and in fact, if I'm watching a documentary on something via YouTube, it's now halfway through. You break up for adverts there as well. So this is a way of generating a little bit of money via an alternative method. And also, you can monitor the number of views. So it could be that if there is interest in a particular German club, German second or third division club, and they're seeing those numbers coming up, they might try to find out, do we have a fan base, in Ontario or Quebec or Vancouver? And it actually could be good from their point of view, because if you then do your homework, you can get in contact with those people, you can sell more shirts and things of this nature. So the reason why it's free is because, without being too rude, that's the value of the product in terms of what a broadcaster is prepared to pay, because broadcasters want to pay for the Premier League, for La Liga, for the Bundesliga, for the Champions League, and so on. If Russian football was available on YouTube, would you watch it? I'm struggling with sort of football overload at present in terms of TV, and that's the domestic game. And you're absolutely right. My marriage would come to a very, very swift halt if I was watching the Paraguayan second division playoffs at 3 a.m. in the morning.
Yeah, I don't watch stuff on YouTube anymore. I try to watch the St. Paul's Suite by Gustav Holst about a year ago, and there's an advert 5 minutes in during a bouncy bit, so I gave up YouTube. That's no good. Also, I noticed that Finley's barking now. Have you taken his chipmunk away? The Baroness.
There's a playtime and there's a non-playtime.
Yes,
it's the same to me.
Yes, let's not go down the Baroness squeaky chipmunk. As we've got another question, we're going into the hour, which I know Guy doesn't like because he pays imaginary overtime to imaginary staff. Apparently, he's like a proper 1970s ITV TV producer, worried about industrial action in case we go over the hour. So our final question comes from Phil Reynolds. Phil Reynolds is a Gillingham fan. Now, I've always not liked Gillingham, but my broadcasting idol was Brian Moore, who was a Gillingham fan. So I've never been able to hate Gillingham as much as I should hate every other club. But Paul says he was looking at the accounts for Gillingham recently and notices that the club now includes a school in their records, which seems unusual. Why would that be the case?
Paul, I think you've got to give Gillingham owner Paul Scally a bit of credit here, because this is a school for 50 pupils who have either been excluded or at risk of exclusion from mainstream education. So it's exclusively for kids in the 11 to 16 area, the age group. The aim of the school is to say, okay, you don't enjoy traditional education, but we're going to sort of piggyback it on the relationship with the football club. So, you know, you will have people from the club coming in. So, you know, in terms of, you know, teaching things about nutrition, you love the club, you'll have some of the club physios coming in to teach you about biomechanics and things of this nature. The coaches will come in occasionally. And I think it's really good as a way of using football as a social good. So the school was opened in 2015. I think it's fair to say initially it had challenges. The first two Ofsted reports were requires improvement, but subsequent to that, its most recent Ofsted report it moved up to good. It's not going to make a lot of money, with only 50 pupils. But I'm impressed. I know there are other clubs that operate similar schemes, but not quite as formal. I'm quite friendly with Mark and Nicola Palios at Tranmere, and I know that they run sort of informal schemes for those kids who have become involved in gangs, who have dropped out of the education system, and they use football because everybody, not everybody, but a significant proportion of young people love football, to try to get them back into the mainstream, to give them a second chance, because there are too many people writing off too many kids who often are being brought up under horrendous circumstances domestically. And any club that's involved in schemes of this nature, big high fives from me and hat is doffed.
Absolutely, because it might not occur to people listening to this pod outside the UK, and I know there are many thousands of you. Gillingham are a club in Kent, and you may associate Kent with the Garden of England, but also, the Medway towns, in which Gillingham lies in the middle, is an area of huge social deprivation. So I think this is a brilliant story. I didn't know about it. And then I'm really annoyed that I didn't know about it, Kieran, because, of course, we hear all the negative stories, but so rarely get a chance to discuss these. And also, it has to be said, when Paul Scally first took over at Gillingham, quite some years ago now, there was more negative publicity about him than many, many club owners at the time. So the fact that he's still there and the fact that Gillingham are doing things like this is... It's wonderful, actually. And I wouldn't, if anybody from Gillingham is listening, I'd be really happy to get you on the show to talk more about this. And I know that other clubs are doing similar things. So thank you, Phil Reynolds, for giving us the chance to have a positive and uplifting way to end this pod. I'm sorry it's gone on a little bit longer than normal. If you have questions for our next pod, our next questions pod, it's questions@priceoffootball.com. And we will be back on Thursday with our news stories, three of which will be the ones we didn't have time to cover today. In the meantime, I shall pass you over to the owner of the Squeaky Chipmunk for his usual farewell message.
Okay, folks, all stay safe. We'll see you on Thursday. Until then, look after yourselves and your loved ones.
Take care, everybody. Bye-bye now.
Bye. The Price of Football. Price of Football.